You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Well, last time I kept you too long because I couldn't stay focused. So I thought I'm going to start a little earlier today, so I won't keep you long. And we'll pick it up here where we left off. But let me say a few things before we do. As I mentioned, there is so much to be said about this great book of Isaiah that I'm going to do this again in the spring, carry it over, because I had prepared probably seven or eight different kind of sessions, and so I'm only going to actually end up, I'll meet again next week. This is the third of four, but as far as the lessons that I had, the sessions I had, I will only get to three, and so I've got five more to go, and I'll try to crowd those in the spring sometime. But, you know, the book of Isaiah is just a masterful book. It's incredibly vast and rich in all sorts of ways, but it's complicated. It's hard to get a hold of. You have to really sink yourself into it, that is, really read it hard, think about it hard, and try to come up with what's holding together all these different oracles and sermons and prophecies and that's crammed in these 66 chapters here. I do think, in many ways, that it's such an important book for the Christian, even though, you know, it's not in the New Testament. However, though, I want to argue it is in the New Testament. If you remember, in Luke chapter 4, the very first sermon that Jesus gives, he quotes from Isaiah, and it's two quotes, a portion of 58 and 61. Now, what sort of interests me about that is, how did Jesus know where to go? If you know anything about it, they did not have codexes, books, like what's indicated here in our picture here. They had scrolls. Come in. They had scrolls. And 66 chapters, if you remember the shrine, it's all around the top, the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is probably one of the greatest archaeological finds in the history of the world, the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's amazing. And I've often wondered, how thick was that scroll? Now, if I'm not mistaken, I think the Dead Sea Scroll itself was about 24, 25 feet long. All right, now think about it. It's on parchment, which is pretty thin, but brittle at times. It was rolled up. How did Jesus know right where to go on this? Now, I've got a point to this. It's not just something curious. I think, now I have no proof of this, I've asked scholars about this, and their argument, I mean, people who really do this for a living, they don't have an answer to this, but my sort of supposition to this is that the scroll was divided into two, maybe three. Three different, or maybe two different scrolls. Because if you have one scroll 25 feet long, and you're going to go to the last part of that, how long would that take you? To sort of wind it out. I don't know. It'd take you a long time. So my guess is it was in multiple scrolls. Now, what to me is significant about that is in multiple scrolls like that, it probably had some history and identity to each of those scrolls. That they, in a way, had a life to themselves and they existed. And the Hebrew people treasured those scrolls and kept them intact. It was that important to them. I'll give you an illustration to this. Good morning. In 2011, I spent a semester in Jerusalem, well, actually just outside of Jerusalem, in a place called the Tantor Ecumenical Institute. And one day, near the end of my semester there, my wife and four other people and I got a guide, and we went down into Hebron, the ancient city of Hebron, one of the oldest cities in the world. It's in the West Bank. It's a very poor town. It is probably 35,000 Arab Muslims. I don't know if there are any Christians that live in Hebron. And there's a Jewish settlement on the inside of it. Very tense, very tense. It was, frankly, the only time those 3.5 months that we were there that I ever felt kind of uncomfortable with the situation that I was in. Be that as it may, we went to the synagogue, which is in the middle, and that synagogue shares with a mosque, a Muslim mosque, the shrines of the patriarchs and matriarchs. You can say Abraham and Sarah, the shrines for them. It was really very incredibly moving experience. But when we went into the synagogue, it was sort of divided up into little rooms, and there were various classes going on. And in the, I guess, sanctuary, they would call it, there were pilgrims who were deaf and mute. In the sanctuary, and we were sort of standing off, and the rabbi went and opened, there's a Hebrew word for this, and I have forgotten it, the cabinet, and inside were two scrolls, there were two. And immediately, all those pilgrims started to cry. Now, my guess was that these were scrolls from a synagogue, maybe in Warsaw, in Eastern Europe, and that they had relatives that had been killed there in Poland, and that those scrolls had that profound attachment to them. And they were passing that scroll around and touching it. What, the reason why I'm thinking about that illustration is that what we're looking at here has been that treasured for all these years, that when Jesus gives his first sermon, I suspect that when he opened it up, there were people there moved to tears by what they were about to hear from this great book. And so I've really tried to learn a lot from it over my, I don't know, the last 30, 40 years or so. And I'm still finding more and more to learn and to digest from this great book. And what I'm trying to do with it today is something, well, the last two Sundays as well, is something rather bold and maybe adventurous on my part. I'm wanting to ask this question: can we learn something from this magnificent book that has shaped generations and centuries of believers who have been touched by God to be faithful to them? Can we learn something from this great book on how to discern God's ways in our lives, in modernity, within the history of the world? I want to think we can, and I've made this argument that we should try at least. And I started this with, if you remember, I've talked about our various doctrines, but with Isaiah chapter 7, when Isaiah goes to King Ahaz in Jerusalem, and the Assyrian army is just outside, and Ahaz does not know what to do, and Isaiah goes to Ahaz and says, "Ask God for a sign. Ask God for a sign." King Ahaz doesn't quite grasp the significance of that question. He is a politician. He is a military leader. Instead, he looks to Assyria for guidance, not to Yahweh for guidance. He did not heed what the prophet told him: ask God for a sign. So I raise this question: what signs can we see of what God is doing in light of what Isaiah says? Can we interpret the courses of history, the forces of nations, the fate of peoples, in light of what we can learn from Isaiah? Now, I'm humble about this. I think about it hard, and I try to come up with cogent arguments about it. But I admit that I'm on thin ice when I make these kind of predictions, because people from the very beginning have been making prophecies that have fallen just flat on their face. I remember when I was in college, maybe the oldest person in the room, but be that as it may, there was a book called The Late Great Planet Earth. Anybody ever heard about that? They were predicting that the world was going to end in 1984, and it was rubbish. Rubbish. Well, how can we not do rubbish when we want to use the book of Isaiah to look for a sign? That's what I want to do. All right. Well, I do think there are conditions that we should keep in mind. I've touched on these already, so this is a rehashing of it, that we should sort of keep in mind when we ask this question: what signs can we see of God? And the first one is this, from Isaiah chapter 5, verse 20, those who call evil good. And he's talking about nations. He's talking about not only Assyria, but he's also talking about Israel at the same time. That Israel itself had become incredibly corrupt and idolatrous, and Isaiah is just adamant in denouncing them for what they are and predicting that God's wrath will fall upon them, which is exactly what it did. Assyria destroys Israel in the year 722 BC. And so he tells the reader here, us, the first thing that we should keep in mind is we should not be so gullible to accept whatever a nation will say is the meaning of human history, or the course of all people, or what is infallible and dogmatically true. We have to be skeptical about this. Just like Ahaz. Ahaz did not listen to God. He listened to Assyria. And remember, I talked about this. He was so enamored with Syria. He went up to Damascus, where Syria had this temple, and he saw their gods, Asherah, there, and had an altar there, and he was so impressed by it. When he went back to Jerusalem, this is the king of Judah. He built an altar in the Holy of Holies to replicate a pagan idol. He was duped by the power and the might and the glitz of Assyria. We should also not be duped. Now, I know we're all good citizens, and I think patriotism is a virtue. I'm not anti-patriotic at all about this. But we also need to be aware that God is not our country, and our country is not God. No country is God. Every country has a tendency to deify itself. Every country has a tendency to deify itself. So Isaiah is saying, be careful here. Think paradoxically about how we assess what the course, the destiny, the righteousness of a nation is. Okay, the second condition is that God has created the world to be inhabitable, not chaotic. This is the nature of God. God is not evil. There is no darkness or shadow change in God. God cannot be evil. God is all good, all necessary, all righteous, all just. Whenever God does something, it is done for order, for goodness. God has created the world to be inhabitable. This is from Isaiah 45:8. We don't look for God in chaos. We don't look for God to, you know, in the midst of human evil and say, okay, this is God. There's God right over there. Another, you know, allusion to my upbringing here. Do you remember those movies, the Planet of the Apes? You know, they've been the remakes, and they're all pretty good, by the way. But the original ones were really, really interesting. And there was this one below the Planet of the Apes. Remember that? Humans had gone down into caves, and the apes had taken over the terrain up there. And there was a whole society down in there, and they had a god. Anybody remember what that god was? An atomic bomb. They worshiped an atomic bomb. That was their god. Now, think about that for a second. All right, if we think of deity, divineness, as just the power of things to overcome and overwhelm things, what's the most overcoming, overwhelming thing that we've ever done? It's the bomb. So why not worship the bomb if that's how we define deity? Well, see, what Isaiah said, that's completely wrong. God does not work in chaos. God works through order. I brought up this issue of the possibility of a just war. I'm going to pause on that for a second and come back to it in just a minute. The third condition here is that God is at work in human history, planting, this is from Isaiah 61:11, the seeds of righteousness and praise in the world. God has not abandoned the world. God has not given it up to darkness, even though darkness reigns. And there's profound, profound wickedness in human history. God has not given up on that. Just like a field that's overgrown with weeds, God has not given up on the field. God has planted seeds, and those seeds will bear fruit. And righteousness is at work right now in human history. That's the point I want to make about this. Where can we see the sprouts, so to speak, of righteousness and praise? How is this happening? What I get off on these things, but I was reading a book this week, a really profound and gripping book. It kind of has been keeping me awake at night. I ought not read kind of things at my age. I have a heart attack, or whatever, but be that as it may. There was a chapter in there about a particular Soviet philosopher named Spielrein, who had an interesting thesis. I'll get to the point here just a second, so bear with me. And her thesis was that, you know, there is no God, there is no really ultimate meaning in the world. All that we have is the drive for self-preservation and reproduction. That's basically what drives everything. And as a consequence of that, we have what she called a death instinct. Now, not that I want to kill myself, but I want to kill you if you attack my self-preservation and and the right of reproduction. And so this death instinct, she argued, explains so much of history. That's why we're always going out to wars, because everybody feels threatened. It's like, you know, human nature is the, you know, people against people. The state of nature is the state of war, and so on. So she was trying to understand all that. And she, you know, was applauded and, you know, promoted within the Soviet system. They used her thinking. In fact, Stalin did, to justify the purges that he commenced, which was absolutely mind-boggling, horrible to think about. For over 3 years, he killed, at an estimate, 1,000 people a day. 1,000 people were killed for political reasons, the Soviet Union, the Great Purge. And she came up with a way to try to justify it. But she was Ukrainian. When the Germans invaded Russia in 1941, they went into Ukraine and were there not all that long, and the Red Army pushed them back, but they refortified themselves. Remember, this was called Operation Barbarossa, and the German army came back into Ukraine. Now, when I read this, I've read a lot about the Holocaust over the years. I did not know this. This is one thing that is keeping me up. In about a four-month period, the German army killed 500,000 Jews in the Ukraine.
In
the Ukraine. Now, they were at war with the Red Army, but they paused long enough to kill 500,000 Jews. She was captured, and they found her remains in a mass grave in which she was buried, everyone with a bullet in the back of their head, with 24,000 other people. That's just mind-boggling. Mind-boggling. You'd think that we would have given up on civilization after something like that. That to realize that such a noble, cultured, and Christian nation as Germany could allow something like that to go on, it's just mind-boggling that humanity can do such horrible things as this. I remember I read once that Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, the famous French philosopher, said after World War II, he said, "There is no God." And he felt like he had a good argument for that. I mean, every city had been bombed mostly. Millions and millions and millions of all kinds of people, the Jews, civilians. More civilians died 10-1 than soldiers in Europe. Civilians. And how can you think there is a God in light of such darkness? Well, see, my point is this. If we believe this book, and we should, if we believe our Lord, if we are committed to what Isaiah says, we have to look for the sprouts of righteousness and praise, even within that chaos. And I think there can be. To me, I'm out on a limb in saying this, but to me, it is a miracle that Europe recovered. I mean, they're not out of the woods, obviously, but they recovered from such mayhem and madness as World War II. In some ways, it's a miracle that people even would decide to want to keep their own lives, their own people, their own families, their own nation going after realizing they could do something like that. But they have. And my answer is that there's some way or another, God has planted a seed of righteousness and praise in those people. And God has not given up on the world, even in light of human evil. All right. So, we don't just gullibly accept whatever people say is right. Secondly, we look for order, not chaos. And thirdly, we look for the seeds of righteousness and praise in human history. All right, I want to get to where I left you last time, and it's with this. I think this is one of the most perplexing and challenging aspects, not only the book of Isaiah, but in just theological thinking, and that is, how can God use a pagan nation to do God's will? That's exactly what Isaiah says. In chapter 10 and elsewhere, he says a couple of times about Assyria, "O Assyria, rod of my wrath." God uses Assyria to judge and punish Israel. Israel's sin was so profound. Their injustices towards the orphans, the widows, and the poor, their unrighteousness in openly and gleefully worshiping idols was so deep into them that God realized that the only way that they could ever, ever be corrected was to be punished. And so God uses Assyria to punish them. It's a rod, like disciplining a... Oh, we, none of you did this. Did you ever beat her with a rod? none of us use rods, hopefully, with our children. But I guess in the old days, they would use... I did get spanked with a switch a number of times. I have to admit that. Maybe that explains why I'm so traumatized as an adult. But, you know, you use a rod. Okay, why do we do that? Well, you've got to learn your lesson. Israel needed to learn her lesson. She was to be faithful to the law of Moses. She was to be consistent with the covenant of Abraham. She was to wait upon the Lord. But what did she do? She became idolatrous. And so how do you correct something that profoundly erroneous and wrong in a people? Now, I mean, you can think about it. Their problem was not peripheral, like changing the tax code. You could change your tax code. Okay, we could do that. Or maybe we could have better zoning here in the city. Yeah, we could fix those problems too. Those are fixable. And most of us think that we can fix most of their problems. Like if you got drafts in your house, go get some weather strips and put it on there. You can fix your problem. But what if I'm the problem? What if it's not that I have a problem, but I'm the problem? How can I fix that? And the answer is no. I need the rod of God's wrath. And that's what Isaiah is saying to Israel. You are your problem. You don't do these things accidentally. I sort of threw away this line one time, maybe the first time. Remember, I made this claim, the essence of blasphemy for Isaiah is, God, we didn't know what you wanted. That's the essence of blasphemy. God, you should have been clearer in what you wanted us to do. God, if we had only known what you wanted, we wouldn't have been so incorrigible and irascible with all this stuff. We wouldn't have been idolatrous. We wouldn't have been oppressing the poor, the orphans, and widows. We would have been perfect if you had only done this for us. And Isaiah says, oh, woe is you. God has been explicit about what God demands of us. Loyalty to the covenant, obedience to the law, faithfulness to God. But we haven't done it. I am my own problem. So what's going to correct this? Now, here's an analogy. I think it's a weak one, but I've struggled to come up with an analogy to understand this. Over the course of my life, I've met a number of people who have gone to AA. And they realize, at least they tell me this, that they were never convinced if they had a problem that they should fix until they hit bottom. You've heard that phrase, hit bottom. And what is the bottom? And the bottom is, I'm helpless. Most everybody thinks they can solve their problem. Or I'll cut it down to just two drinks a day, or I'll, you know, just one bit of psychedelic drugs or something, or whatever. I'll manage this myself. And what happens is that you're still under the throes of that addiction. Until you, quote, hit bottom. Well, Israel had not hit bottom. So what do these people do when they finally hit bottom? They go get help. They go to AA. They rely upon a power higher than themselves. They look for sustenance and grace to come into their lives. They receive mercy. They realize they cannot do it themselves. So let's look at it like this. Like I said, it's somewhat of a weak analogy. But the rod here is like convincing these people that you are at the bottom, and until you rely upon God, the grace and mercies of God, you are helpless and hopeless. And so the rod here is to convince Israel of that. And so how does Isaiah see this happening? If I had a map up here, here's an imaginary map. You know, here's Jerusalem, Mediterranean coast. This area here in the bottom is called Judah. This area up here is called Israel after the death of Solomon. Assyria is up here where Nineveh is. All right, Assyria is coming here. They've also been attacking Judah some, but they're coming here. They're right on the outskirts of this. And so the people are thinking, well, you know, we can handle this problem. We're pretty smart. We're resourceful. We can do this. And Isaiah is saying, no, you can't. You're going to need a rod to fix your problem. And so God is going to use a pagan nation to correct Israel, which should be a nation committed to God. Now, I know that sounds like a contradiction in terms. In fact, Isaiah even says, these guys over there, they don't know me. Tiglath-Pileser, he doesn't have the foggiest idea of who I am, but I am going to use him to do so. Now, like I said, I'm on thin ice. I probably will collapse here. Pull me out if I'm going down for the third count. How can that be? What is God doing when God uses Assyria to punish Israel? How can God work through pagan nations, regardless of what that nation is? How is that possible? Here is my interpretation, all right? You probably smarter than I am, more thoughtful than I am, and you can come up with some other cogent reason. But I look at it like this, that God used the law and the order of society in Assyria to correct Israel. It was their rule of law, and it was their ability to bring order to society that God was going to use to correct Israel. Here is this great nation, a powerful nation. I tell you, it's one of the wonders of the world. Museums throughout all the world have whole exhibits just committed to the glory of the Assyrian civilization. So I would say, just from, 30,000 feet, there's something rather enviable about these people. They had their act together, so to speak. They could put things in order. They could build these great buildings. They had a system of purpose about that. All that is not necessarily made by them, but it's the quality that God gives to all people to make the world inhabitable. Even someone who does not know God still can experience the benefits of the goodness of the creation that God has made. And I think that's what Assyria was doing. My hunch is this, it's a Sansom interpretation, is that God was going to use that ability of Assyria to bring order and civilization to a people, even though they were pagan. And that's how God was going to correct Israel. Like I said, it's worth about a cup of coffee, but that's my ability, my effort here to make sense out of those. How can God use a pagan nation? Two assumptions here. One, God has made the world good and orderly, whether one knows that or not. Whatever goodness and orderliness is in the world, whatever is inhabitable about the world, is a gift of God's creation. Even those who know not nothing, who know nothing about God, nonetheless experience the great benefits and blessings of God. And a nation that has built up this great civilization here still has, in some ways, an indication of the creative goodness of God. I think Isaiah says Assyria here can be used to overcome the chaos that is in Israel. However, Assyria was idolatrous. Assyria deified itself, and they went overboard. They weren't there. They did not just correct Israel, they destroyed Israel. They didn't go and just reinstitute a civilized order to things. What they did, they went in and killed over 24,000 and deported the rest. That's an estimate, 24,000 I read someplace. They deported the rest. And that was never God's intention. God does not use chaos to work goodness. God uses order to establish goodness. And God intended Assyria to do that very thing. All right. I think last time I went over a little bit of the history there about how God destroyed Israel and how God punished Israel, but Assyria perverted that urging, that use of God into a destructiveness. And for that reason, Assyria is also destroyed. Nations that create chaos and evil in the world, that bring darkness and mayhem and misery to people, will be judged by God. And that's exactly what happens to Assyria. There's a wonderful scene described in Isaiah chapter 37, and it's also in, hold on one second, Chronicles. I forget, 2 Chronicles 18, I believe it is. But the Assyrian army is just outside of Jerusalem. They had already conquered Israel and destroyed it. and the Assyrian army is just outside the walls of Jerusalem. And they start to mock the Israelites and mock the God of Israel, saying, "You cannot defend yourself with this God. Our gods are stronger than yours." It is said that an angel of death came upon the armies of Assyria and killed 185,000 of them. That's what's recorded there. 185,000 of the Assyrian army was obliterated. The king, Sennacherib, goes back to Nineveh, and it is recorded there. While he goes to a temple, the temple of the god Asherah, and he is praying to his god. And while he is praying, his sons sneak in and assassinate him. Now, that's politics, isn't it? If you're going to live by the sword, you're going to die by the sword. If you're going to bring such shame and, you know, ignoble results upon our people, you're going to suffer for this. Even the king is not above that kind of retribution. And so Assyria eventually falls to Babylon at the Battle of Nineveh, and they are no more. They're no more. All right, there are a couple of things I want to say here, and then I'll just go over this for a couple of minutes, and then I'll move on. How can we discern God's wrath in the world? God does have wrath. There's no doubt about it. Wrath is needed. Now, I guess if we wanted a theology that sees God as sort of an indulging grandfather that's always giving out treats to grandchildren, then that wouldn't make any sense. In fact, that would sound rather offensive, that God has wrath. And a lot of theology is based on this idea. You know, God is all love. Therefore, God doesn't have any wrath. Well, that's a total misreading of Scripture. Even in the New Testament, there's wrath of God and the great judgment. So what is this wrath? It is God's effort to restore order and goodness to the world. And sometimes the only way in which that can happen is through extreme measures. All right. First, we must base our answer on God's power, not on the power of nations. I should not look to Assyria to define what is God's wrath. I should look to God to understand God's wrath. Assyria is not God. No country is God. Babylon wasn't God. Rome wasn't God. And you know, you can go to places there in the Middle East and see the ruins of Babylon. You can go all over the Mediterranean world and see ruins of the Roman Empire. They're not the wrath of God. God uses them to correct the sort of infernal disposition that people have to do great harm and destruction in the world. God is working to bring order and inhabitability to the world, and whatever it takes to do so. And sometimes it takes driving people to the bottom. My analogy of addiction. You got to hit the bottom. Sometimes the people have to hit the bottom. And God takes people to the bottom in order for them to learn to grow seeds of righteousness and praise. I want to make a little sort of a, this, I will only be able to touch on this, it's such a deep issue, and that's, how can we know the difference between God's wrath and human evil? Let's think about this. Can God do evil? Now let's think. Evil is chaos, it's destructiveness. It is the sort of the moral opposition of goodness. Evil is not just accidents. If I have a car wreck going home, I'm not going to say that's necessarily evil. It's hard, you know, very unfortunate. But it's not necessarily evil. Is this intent to destroy the goodness that God has put into the world? God, being all good, all wise, all loving, does not wish to destroy the goodness that God has done in the world. There's one thing that I think, in light of the overall teaching of Scripture, we can be absolutely convinced of, and that is whatever God has revealed of who God is, we can trust that to be the nature of God. God is not playing tricks with us. God's not this kind of petty deity that sort of confuses and manipulates us and, you know, deceives us. Not what God does. God does very clearly. That's Isaiah's point. And we know that as Christians. This is the first Sunday of Advent. And what are we witnessing? the light of the world, not the shadow of the world, but the light of the world come in to the shadows of the world. And so God works in ways to bring order and habitability into the world. Human evil only brings chaos and destruction. Thirdly, if anything should convince us, in light of just a very sort of superficial reading of human history, is that all nations become ruins at one time. All nations become ruins at one time. Nobody was better at conquering the world than the Romans. I mean, we're pretty good at it, I guess. I'm not saying we're necessarily evil, but the Romans controlled, you know, the known world very, very successfully for centuries and centuries and centuries. And what are they now? I mean, it's impressive, but they're still just ruins. None of them are eternal. None of them have outlived their own limitations. And so we need to believe that. And so when we look at history, in fact, this is something that maybe all of us ought to reflect upon on occasion. What became of Assyria? They were indomitable. What became of Babylon? They were undefeated. They even defeated Egypt. What became of Rome? Rome had no foes that were serious foes for centuries and centuries. And I could go on and on and on. What has become of those countries? Each country, each one of them, tended to deify themselves. That we are the crown of creation, that we are the reason why there is a human history to begin with. That all that has occurred before us has prepared the world for us. Every country feels that way. But in light of the great wrath of God, they now exist as ruins. And that should tell us something. That should tell us that we cannot put our trust ultimately in what these tell us we should do. It has to be within, you know, the covenant of Abraham, the law of Moses, the revelation of Jesus Christ. I'm going to pause here. If you have a thought about this, like I said, I don't want to be dogmatic about it, even though I'm trying to be emphatic. I've thought about all this. What do you think? I'm welcome to be challenged on this. We're on thin ice. Yes.
I think the assumptions that are included, that you even mentioned with regard to this, support the previous assumptions. I don't think that some of them stand alone. How does one know that God has influenced Syria for Israel? What gives us the right to think that God controls everything as opposed to just letting it happen and your reward is eternity with Him? So, you know, as playing a devil's advocate, I just have a problem with the interpretation based on assumptions.
Well, the assumption, I think, was one of the clear doctrines of our faith, and that we believe in God the Father, the maker of heaven and earth. Now, that earth has been marred by sin and, you know, scarred deeply by human evil, but God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. That God has not given up on the world. And so God is working in a way not just to redeem my soul and your soul, but to redeem the world into a new heaven and a new earth. So I think that's constitutive to our faith, that God is a God of nations, not just the God of individual souls, that God is the Lord of human history, and that God is so committed to that which God has made that God's not going to give up on it.
Well, it boils down to you choose to accept and think about all of these things. We study and apply current theory to create facts or to uncover facts. But the bottom line is we choose to have faith. We choose to believe. So, therefore, you can choose not to believe, obviously. And I'm not suggesting one is better or worse than the other, but Choice, then, does not require fact. Fact does have a tendency to influence choice, but I've long been a student, and my wife can tell you this, of the Old Testament exists so that you see the fulfillment of it in Christ. I don't know why you can't start there, as opposed to all this,
yeah,
the first 50 books.
Well, I think one of the reasons to bear in mind is that Christ affirms the Old Testament, that it is the Scripture that Christ quotes and relies upon. The apostles also rely upon the Old Testament to understand who Christ is. Isaiah, and we're going to be talking about this, I won't be able to do it today, but we'll be talking about this. Isaiah chapter 53 is one of the most quoted chapters in all the New Testament. And it's Isaiah's vision of how God's going to redeem the world, and it's through the suffering servant. This is the challenge that I'm trying to give, and I understand your point. One little quick point. You're right. When it boils down to it, I am faced here with God. What will I choose? There is a mystery to human freedom. I admit that. But I am choosing for what God has revealed of who God is. My choice does not make God true. My choice is true if it is in line with what God has revealed. Yes, there was a...
Yeah, Aunt Peggy. Yeah, I was just going to make the point in Isaiah 7, verse 18, it's clear that God's hand is behind Assyria and Egypt. It says, in that day, the Lord will whistle for the fly, which is at the source of the streams of Egypt, and for the bee, which is in the land of Assyria.
Yeah.
So you see a real direct, impulse of God,
yeah,
to use both Egypt and Assyria
right,
bringing Israel right back to him.
And then he does it again in Habakkuk with the Chaldeans.
Exactly. Exactly.
He's like, don't worry, I got this covered. I'm going to bring the Chaldeans. What?
Yeah, just quickly, the bells are ringing. In Isaiah chapters 15 and 16, he talks about Moab, and Moab, in a long list of about 15 other countries, is being judged by God because they're unjust in their pride, and also the harms they've done to God's people. And Moab is destroyed and just left in ruins there, and thousands of refugees are leaving Moab. There in Jerusalem, remember when we would look, I guess it would be west, is that right, or south, I forget. Anyway, there was called the Hills of Moab, just on the other side of the River Jordan, modern-day Jordan. But even in that, God cares for those refugees, and they know nothing about God, and they were cruel to God's people, but God cares for those refugees. And in chapter 16, God tells the people of Jerusalem to welcome these Moabites as refugees. God has not given up on a corrupt world. That's the point that I'm trying to make here. How can we discern that? Okay, I didn't get as far as I wanted to, but I appreciate the comments. Think about it, all right? I have an email address, dlsansom@yahoo.com. If you want to write me, I'll engage you in all this, or at sanford.edu. I have two. And next week when I come back, I'm going to talk about something even more difficult to understand. How can a baby, a young child, stand down the forces of the armies? How is that possible? All right, let me say a prayer. We ask your blessings upon us, O God, during this great Advent service season. May our hearts be prepared by these great texts that we are considering and our reflection upon them to see even more of the light that you brought into the world. This I pray, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you'll join us for one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.